Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Thanks so much for joining us on Sunday night. Well, this week's conversation has been dominated by the federal budget, particularly the politics of broken promises. But there's also a broader question. Does the budget mark a sea change for Australia? Or have we, as Manning Clark once put it, merely again exchanged the enlargers for the punishers and straighteners? For many, as for Manning Clark, this debate is one of the constants of our political and social history for over a century. Some mark it as having even deeper roots in our colonial origins. The differences, for instance, between Melbourne and Sydney, one as a planned city, the other as a free market jostle for the best position. The religious cultures, Sydney the home of hard-headed Calvinist individualism, Melbourne communitarian Methodism. And with the prospect of federation a century ago, of the colonies into a nation, the central division was between the free marketeers of New South Wales and the protectionists of Victoria. And also, with the federation debates, another continuing element was added to the mix. How much centralisation? For the Liberal Party, it may mark the final triumph in both an ideological and geographical shift from the Deaconite soft liberalism of federation and Menzies Melbourne to the hard-edged market rationalists of the Emerald City. If we are witnessing a sea change, is it any more of a turn to the right than the Whitlam It's Time turn to the left in 1972? Well, to discuss this and many other factors that may relate to the budget and your experience of it, it's a pleasure to welcome into our studios, in our Canberra studio, first up in particular, Lynn Hatfield-Dodds, National Director of Uniting Care Australia, and Peter Martin, Economics Editor of The Age newspaper in Melbourne. Welcome to you both.
G'day.
G'day, John.
Thanks for joining us. And in our Melbourne studio, Anglican Bishop Philip Huggins, Anglican Assistant Bishop of Melbourne. Philip Huggins, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good evening.
And here in Sydney, Phil Glendenning of the Edmund Rice Centre and currently CEO, President of the Refugee Council of Australia. Yep. Phil Glendenning, thanks for joining us.
Good evening, John.
Well, can I ask Peter Martin, you first, a couple of economic questions. First, is there a budget problem and how urgently does it need to be addressed?
It doesn't need to be addressed urgently. Indeed, the government hasn't addressed it urgently for very good reasons. The economy is a little weak at the moment, so you don't want to, just as mining is going off a deeper than expected cliff, that's the investment in mining, all of those construction workers essentially looking around for something to do. It's probably not the right time to really cut back on government spending, and they haven't. They've ramped it up. In fact, government spending increases to the highest rate in quite some years in this budget, 25.3% of GDP. I think it was only topped by that briefly a few years back. So they're doing that in order to they're spending the money on roads and so on to employ those construction workers. So clearly there isn't an urgent budget crisis. Underneath that, yes, there is. Now, the crisis isn't what people think, which is debt. Debt's not a problem for a government. It's a problem for an individual, but who tends to borrow from only one lender and has a limited lifespan, but governments like companies go on forever, so it's not really a problem. They borrow and repay all of the time. There is a problem with the increasing interest bill, which is getting quite large. It's 9% of the budget now. It's getting quite big. It's on track to go to 12%. So, yes, there is an economic, there is a financial problem. It's doesn't need to be urgently solved, and the government isn't urgently solving it, and shouldn't.
Just explore that for a bit. That interest bill, I saw a graph recently in one of the newspapers which indicated that it wasn't too often in the history of federation, in fact, that we'd come out of debt and entered into a surplus period, and most often that period of government debt had been longer and larger than the one we're experiencing at the moment.
Well, at settlement, John, when Australia was first settled, invaded, if you like, the foreign debt was infinite as a proportion of measured GDP. It's been above...
Depends on your starting point.
It's been above 100% of GDP in the early part of Federation. How it came down was we all got richer. The foreign debt didn't really come down. The government debt didn't really come down. What happened was that as a proportion of GDP, it came down because, we sold wool recently. We've been selling iron ore and so on. It's people confuse debt with government debt with individual debt, and for reasons that I sort of hinted at there, but would take too long of a conversation to go into, but I have written about them. They almost have only the name in common. Now, the government has serious budget problems because of that increasing interest bill. That's the medium-term problem. Even more serious in the future, where demanding, quite rightly, to spend more on health, and this isn't wasted money because the health treatments are much better than they used to be, and we want them as we're getting older. Health is most easily provided by the government.
So there are demands built in, and they're built in by political decision.
Yeah, yes. Now, this is what was wrong with the Commission of Audit report, I suppose the biggest blind spot, the one that came out just before the budget, and also the biggest blind spot in the budget. The Commission of Audit said tax should not rise above 24% of GDP. They just sort of picked that number because it was about where it is now. But if you look at the history of Australian opinion, the ANU does a survey before each election, you'll see that for since the 90s, since the early to mid-90s, people's desire to spend more, or rather people's desire to have government spend money on health has been increasing. People's desire to have tax cuts has been going down. The two have crossed over. There are now more and an increasing number of people essentially wanting more tax in order to have it spent on health. This is not surprising. We are getting richer. As we get richer, naturally we're no longer as concerned about, as some people are, but most of us are no longer as concerned about making ends meet, paying the grocery bills. We're concerned about we've moved on from primary, we're concerned about secondary, then tertiary goods.
Quality of
life.
And
one of them is health, and it's something which you can't buy, but people do everything they can to buy it. And that's why the proportion of GDP, the proportion of national income we spend on tax will rise because we will want it to rise. Well, and this is almost inevitable. There's no fixed reason why it should be at the moment, but that's not the mindset of the government or the Commission of Audit.
Let me ask a second question that's been bandied about quite heavily over the last week. Is the heavy lifting disproportionately falling on one group economically rather than the other? That is, the general line is that this is disproportionate. If we've got to solve a problem, it should be shared equitably, and this isn't. It's falling far more on those who take services than those who have the money to not need the services.
Massively. Tomorrow morning we have an exclusive story in the Age and Sydney Morning Herald. Two academics from the Australian National University, Professor Peter Whitford is one of them, have constructed the missing table in the budget. Every budget since 2005 there's been a table called, it has different names at different times, it's often called Detailed Family Outcomes. They take different types of families, a single mother with a child who's six, all sorts of different types, and work out the effects on them. For the first time in 9 years, that table was missing on Tuesday night, so the ANU team have reconstructed it. It's not pretty, but it answers your question. You'll see that the losses in income per week are really big for poor people, low-income people. The biggest that they identified was a single person on Newstart, 23 years old, loses 18% of their disposable income as they go back to the youth allowance. The smallest was a two-income couple with no children on the average wage and 150% of the average age wage, one on each. They lose zero per week, nothing. The next smallest was a single person earning three times the average earnings. That's paying this deficit levy. That person loses 0.9%, a bit less than 1% of disposable income. There is no doubt. And if you look at the decisions they've made, the things they've chosen not to cut, they haven't cut the private health insurance rebate. Costs $5 billion a year. It's going to cost $6 billion next year. They haven't cut that. And it goes disproportionately to people on high incomes. It certainly goes... people on low incomes almost definitionally don't take it out because they can't afford the premiums. Money to private schools. In this coming year, $6.8 billion in Commonwealth grants. The following year... this is largely as a result of Gonski, it jumps to $9.3 billion. Now, the Commonwealth could have decided that this was money they wanted to cut back on. Instead, they've cut back on benefits, what they call welfare, but the benefits and welfare which go to higher income earners, they've decided to leave untouched. There is a very clear pattern of, if you like... looking after friends getting money from people, shall we say, with less of a voice. I mean, I approve on the whole of what they've done economically. The levers they've chosen to do it betray their preferences and essentially who their mates are and aren't.
So we are looking at a budget that essentially, using the device of an economic measure, is as much about social engineering, that is changing the balance between the rich and the poor.
Well,
and
you've got two things happening at once. Yeah. It's a bit like, John, you're into the Bible. It's a bit like how the Bible can tell two stories at once. You know, one sometimes a different story on a deeper meaning, and the other the surface story. The surface story is they are returning to surplus slowly in order not to tank the economy. That makes sense. The measures they've taken make sense looked at in that way. But then if you look at who wins and who loses from the measures, you'll see there are very clear values, preferences, and they tell a different story. They're both happening at the same time.
Lynn Hatfield Dodds, let me bring you in here, because what I'd like to get is a couple of examples from you that demonstrate this most clearly.
Well, not an example, but kind of a numerical metric. If you look at this budget, who's doing the heavy lifting and who's carrying the burden? Cuts to family payments, income support and pensions total around $12 billion. That's four times the size of the temporary levy on high-income earners, which comes in at $3.1 billion. That levy is temporary over 3 years. The $12 billion that more vulnerable Australians are going to be bearing is permanent. So 12 to 4, my next number is $1 billion, and that's being very generous. Industry is heavy lifting to the extent of $845 million that come in the cessation of a whole lot of tax expenditures. There's a few other bits and bobs, but basically industry are picking up around 1/12 the burden of Australia's more disadvantaged people. So Peter's right in terms of who's heavy lifting. It's not wealthy Australians and it's not Australian business. It's Australians who are struggling to make ends meet.
What then becomes the benchmarks for you in terms of people? Where do you see it most as Uniting Care as impacting on your services?
We'll see. Look, one of the changes, there's a whole lot of changes people have been talking about a week to the health system through co-payments, the deregulation of tertiary education, so changes to our education system. And certainly in terms of my world in social services, really big changes to the welfare system. A lot of those are going to be kind of slow burn changes through indexation, but new start changes for Australians under 30 for young people start almost immediately. And there'll be 6 month cycles for people, 6 months with They're calling it a waiting period with no income support whatsoever. Second 6 months, you have income support and you've got to work for the dole. Third 6 months, no income support. And then until you keep a job, you're cycling on and off income support at six-month periods. And I think that's going to be really difficult for people. On the one hand, we say, and I happen to agree with this, that work for the dole, when properly constructed, can assist people to rehearse some essential skills, both life skills, job readiness skills, and hopefully practical concrete skills to take people into a trade or a particular place of work. If that's the case, why would you have people on income support and rehearsing those behaviours for 6 months of the year, then in free fall for another 6 months of the year?
There's also a rhetorical flourish which accompanies the youth, the changes affecting young people. Kevin Andrews, quote, "The days of easy welfare for younger Australians are over." That's almost a sort of dog whistle to the dole bludger sort of
Well, I tell you, if welfare was ever easy for young people, however it's been, whatever that benchmark has been, and however one would describe it, and I wouldn't describe it as easy, it's about to get quantums more difficult.
So what is the employment situation for young people? I mean, the unemployment rate for young people is higher, but is there any research evidence that young people are less prone to take up work than older folk?
The evidence around young people looking for work, attaching to jobs and maintaining jobs, the indicators are around whether they have a stable home life. They don't need to be living with their family of origin, but they need to have somewhere safe and secure and stable to live. They need to have a relatively supportive workplace, and they need to earn enough to be able to support themselves clearly. Now, those things are not always the case for young people coming into work. One of the things this budget does, one of the measures that I think is terrific, is there is a payment of $10,000 for employers that take on Australians 50 years and over. That's terrific. But you kind of think, well, that's another little bit of an odd that's going to be stacked against Australians under 30. So I'm an employer. I'm looking at somebody 29 years of age, somebody 51 years of age. The 51-year-old is coming to me with $10,000. The 29-year-old is not. So, you know, I think we're going to see young people through our doors in the second half of this year, one imagines, looking for emergency relief.
The other element that has been mentioned to me is that word emergency relief. A number of churches and welfare agencies are saying, hang on, at a very time that government cutbacks are going to affect us, we're going to have far more demands on our system for people knocking on the door and saying, can I have a food voucher?
Yeah, and look, it's not clear what's happening with that. The social service budget has been broadbanded. Rather than having a plethora of smaller programs, I couldn't tell you how many, I suspect hundreds, they're in seven streams now. And we've supported this approach. It means that it should be easier for service providers to access funding. It should be more flexible. There should be less administration. So that fits with the budgets, with the government's kind of really strong commitment, and Minister Andrews' strong commitment to reducing red tape.
Would you share the view that what we're looking at here as we discussed with Peter, that here we're looking at a budget which actually shifts. It's a budget that's about a view of Australia and how Australia should organise itself. That it's a pretty foundational shift in your experience from the way these things have been dealt with in the past.
Look, without a doubt, I mean, every year, I and others say budgets are about priorities. They absolutely are. And if you look into any budget that any government's ever delivered, it gives you a sense of the government's view of the country and also, I guess, the amount of energy and bottle, if you like, that the government have to deliver on that view. You can see, I think, a pretty clear direction for the country in this year's budget, and I think the government have drawn a line in the sand and said we're up for delivering on that vision. I think without a doubt, if you were going to evaluate this budget on does it take the country in a particular direction and will it succeed in that, I'd have to score it pretty highly. If you look at, you know, the changes to health, to education, to welfare, as Peter said, the kind of tax measures they didn't go after. They didn't go after the massively inequitous superannuation tax concessions, for example. We've done nothing about making income taxes permanently more progressive. So there's a range of things that government have done, there's a range of things that they haven't done, and all of those things, I think, point you in a particular direction. The front bench have been very clear since the election in saying again and again and again, the role of government is simply and only to do for citizens what they cannot do for themselves. And that's a particular conservative view of the role of government, and I think this this budget picks that up well. The other aspect we haven't talked about yet is the push to the states, pushing a whole lot of service delivery around health in particular to the states. And there's been a lot of commentary this week about is the political strategy behind that to have the states screaming for GST reform?
Well, we'll get to that in a moment. But Phil Glendenning, let me bring you into the conversation here. Lynn briefly mentioned the shock horror, $80 million delivered to the states in hospitals and education. But the aid budget also received a pretty substantial chop, and also some notion that aid will be redirected.
Yes.
Now, how do we stand in the international community here? I noticed, for example, that some people have quoted the Conservative Prime Minister in Britain, David Cameron, saying that we're not prepared to solve our budget problems on the back of the poor of the world, and maintaining a commitment to the Millennium Goals and those sorts of things which everybody was talking about a few years ago. Where does Australia stand with regard to those things now?
Well, we are prepared to balance the budget on the back of the world's poor. The world's poor are making the biggest single contribution to the Australia's so-called fiscal crisis, as Peter's clearly outlined, isn't really occurring, because there's been a $7.6 billion cut in foreign aid. In the budget, the government's has frozen foreign aid at $5 billion for the next 2 years, and in a big change, is going to link increases in the future to the consumer price index, as opposed to measuring aid as a percentage of gross national income. Now, that means now that Australia will be looking at providing 0.29% of our GDP in aid, when countries like Britain, David Cameron, as you said, they've now met their commitment, which Australia's pledged to do, of 0.7%. This is, to be put simply, callous. And in a particularly for Australia, who, you know, currently we are, according to world income levels, the second highest median income country on earth after Switzerland, but we're not located where Switzerland are. We're located in a region that is full of very poor and very vulnerable people, and it would make some sense that to be in the interest of stability in the region and also assisting some of the world's most vulnerable people. I mean, aid is a small share of the total expenditure in the budget, but it's now effectively in decline, and we're looking down the barrel of a 10% real cut in Australia's overseas aid by 2016-17.
That's also been linked to a redirection in the philosophy of aid as well.
Yes, well as you know, AusAid's now is part of Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, so it's linked to trade, but there's been very big resourcing out of this budget towards Papua New Guinea. And other areas of the region, the very close region. And that, of course, is linked to what's going on with Manus Island and refugees and asylum seekers and what's been done in that area.
The aid budget, part of AusAid, was linked by the Labor government, it must be said, into the aid budget, as if it was part of an international aid budget. Is that sort of sleight of hand still going on?
Well, I think so. And I think aid is not trade. Aid is different to trade. And that was an important distinction that should have been maintained. We are, judging by this, balancing the books, or attempting to, in years down the track, getting back to surplus on the backs of the poor, both here and overseas. Mm-hmm. I should also add, John, there's been $500 million cut out of Aboriginal Affairs programs in this budget. You know, this is really an attempt to widen the gap. And I think it fits with the discussion you're having with Lynn to say that, you know, this is a clear mechanical decision on who to target. And we start with the poor, both here and internationally. And, you know, as I said, in terms of overseas aid, you look at the other countries that have got AAA credit ratings, you know, like the Scandinavians, like Canada, they're all meeting their obligations to the world's poor.
They're working towards a goal of 0.7, of GDP?
Of GDP, that's right.
GDP going towards aid. Where do we stand on that?
Well, we're 0.29 now. 0.29. This is... and we were pledged, before the election, to get to 0.5, and the Labor Party had pledged to do that also. But that's why this is a a savage reversal of that trend. And for us in this region, it's callous. Morally, it can't be defended. And, you know, intellectually, given where we live, it's not smart.
Philip Huggins, let me bring you into the discussion here. And I want to go to the other big issue that's been raised in the week, one of trust. That is, look, this government are quite entitled, are they not, to alter the direction of the country, just as Whitlam did in 1972, so Abbott can do in 2013. And shouldn't we just get used to it? Others are saying, well, yes, that's one thing, but the other issue is that prior to Whitlam in 72, there was this huge lead-up and people knew exactly where the government was taking us. In this case, there was a series of statements made. For instance, Tony Abbott, well, I can understand why just at the moment politicians aren't much trusted, because we've had too many politicians who say one thing before an election to win votes and then do the opposite after the election. Now, that was in 2013. Tony Abbott gave us that advice. Also, a simple line, no cuts to education, no cuts to health, no change to pensions, no change to the GST, and no cuts to the ABC or SBS. In September 2013, on the eve of the election, very simple sentence, about five promises broken in that one, I think. The issue of trust. Should we be used to politicians not keeping their word? And if there's a, do you agree there's a sea change, and should we be discussing it in those terms?
Well, I think why there is the level of disappointment that we've been hearing through the week and including in our conversation so far is that on the basis of what the government said they would do in the election campaign, we didn't see this coming. On the basis of the promises they made, and you just re-enunciated some of them, these things were not expected. And I think you've seen in the streets of our cities today some of that disappointment as people have gone out to convey their disappointment. Now, it is a really, really serious moral issue because, you know, we know we, as human beings, as social beings, we don't function instinctually. We rely on shared symbols to keep our lives together, particularly language. And every major religion has at the essence of it as an ethic that we have to be able to trust each other's words. We have to be able to rely on each other's words in order for human society to function. We have to be able to believe that what people promise is what they will do. And certainly for people of faith, right at the heart of it is our trust in God's word, as that's the heart of our lives. God's trustworthiness gives us peace. It is our peace. And really the essence of a democracy is that people say this is what they're going to do. On that basis, we vote for them. If afterwards they then do something entirely different, well, this is extremely dangerous to the quality of our democracy. It's not just a matter of politics, and it's not something we should just get used to, because it actually damages the quality of trust between an elected government and the people, and it leads people to then wonder, then how do we get our needs met? And we see overseas some of the social chaos that can result when people lose trust that their governments will do as they've said they will.
Isn't this part of a deliberate rhetorical thrust, though, that for much of the past 30 years, I guess beginning with Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, there was an anti-government thrust to much of the political debate. Ronald Reagan famously said, government is not the solution, government is the problem. And of course, Margaret Thatcher declared there's no such thing as society. So we are in a political environment in which some feel it as part of the game to allow distrust of government, because that serves a broader political end.
It's not a game, and it's not something we should just accept, because it does actually make a difference to the quality of people's well-being. I think what we're seeing at the moment is enormous disappointment in our country. There's both the disappointment that a wonderful opportunity to build a great civilization here is kind of getting squandered a little, but there's also the disappointment that we cannot trust that what governments say they'll do. We had the same issue with the former government, and Lynn and I were involved, for example, with others in the issue of gambling reform, and we thought we had something that was going to be really significant in terms of gambling reform. The churches and the government and Senator Wilkie at the time put that arrangement together, and then it was walked away from. And And then so this government that's elected now made such a thing, and the current Prime Minister made such a thing about going to be a trustworthy government. That actually amplifies the responsibility to do that.
Philip Huggins, I'm also hearing echoes of another debate that happened 100 years ago, and it was certainly debated in church circles 100 years ago and put to one side as being unsatisfactory. That is the debate over a deserving and an undeserving poor.
Well, yes, there's, you're poor, you need help, you need a support, you need encouragement. I think one of the things that's really disappointing about this budget is the lack of emotional intelligence, particularly with regards to the young. You know, there's so many young people who already feel extraordinarily vulnerable. Brotherhood of St. Lawrence's research on youth unemployment shows some areas 20% youth unemployment, long time already out of work, just needing a context where they can find out what their gifts are, feel somebody believes in them, encourages them, gives them an opportunity. Too many young people feel flat, low self-esteem, depressed, anxious. I mean, there's not a good read of the mood of the people in this, and it's not good for vulnerable people. And, politicians are so resilient in themselves, and they across all the detail, but they can sometimes just forget what the effect of their words and the mood of them can be on vulnerable people. Poor people need support and encouragement, so they're not poor. So they've got the dignity of work, housing that they can afford, and a normal life. Everybody aspires to that.
You're on Sunday nights on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia via the web to the world. We're debating and discussing the ethics of the budget recently brought down by the federal government, and you can join the conversation, 1300 800 222, 1300 800 222. If you've got questions to ask or contributions you'd like to make, please feel free to join us. Join us with our panel, Bishop Philip Huggins, the Assistant Anglican Bishop of the Diocese of Melbourne, Lynn Hatfield Dodds, National Director of Uniting Care Australia, Peter Martin, Economics Editor for The Age newspaper, and Phil Glendenning, President of the Refugee Council of Australia. Peter Martin, just briefly before we take some calls, the government is pleased to paraphrase in various ways that a rising tide raises all boats, yet that statement stands this week in stark contrast with the thesis of a book that topped the Amazon bestseller list last week, Capital by Thomas Piketty, a book that maintains that the richer a society grows, the larger the gap between the rich and the poor will become. And I think it was also summed up some 20 years ago in a rather mordant aphorism by Joseph Heller of Catch-22 fame, when he offered the observation, a rich society requires a very large number of poor people.
Yeah, it's this idea of generational transmission of inequality. And there are some measures in the budget that actually increase it. The change to university funding will enable universities to charge very high fees, some of them, the elite ones, and they'll essentially be put out of the reach of people, you know, who until now, you know, for the last 30 or 40 years have, whatever their circumstances, been able to get in to university.
Also I understand yeah. There's a compounding issue in that, that if, say, you get a 100,000 degree, that's dollar degree, that's tough enough. But on top of that, you've got interest rates which are no longer to be at 2%, but around the market rate of 6%.
And they begin
from the moment you enroll, not from the moment you end.
This matters, though, not for people who are already educated from educated families and perhaps have confidence in their ability to succeed in the workplace. There have been studies showing that the people who are put off by the prospect of big student loans, and the student loans are going to become much bigger now, are the people who are already feeling uneasy about going into university, right? Mm. So those things are set to compound inequality. We also have it with the school system, which as I said, there's been no cutback to subsidies for private schools. And this too means that students, children of high-income, educated parents tend to go to the better schools, even if they're not better. At least they know people who can give them a job in daddy's firm. And other people not coming from those background find they're in schools without even, in some parts of Sydney, without even good students or concerned parents or parents with the time and resources to lift the standards. Mm. So inequality is increasing and it's happening all around the world. But this budget, if anything, gives it a little bit of a push.
Let's take your calls, 1300 800 222. And it's first up is David in Sydney. Hello, David. How are you?
How you going, Peter?
Yeah, great. What would you like to say?
Look, I think the problem is, as someone, I was raised a Christian, but I was really upset with the budget. And what's, apart from some of the things, the measures like the unemployment, waiting 6 months to get on it, I think is way too extreme. I'm really, really upset about how they've lied. I mean, I heard, for example, Tony Abbott on another radio station, when asked about Medicare before the election, said he was quite happy the way Medicare was. He thought it worked fairly well, and he had no plans to change. What happens? A $7, you know, co-payment. And I just think it's terrible that people are so accepting, and I think people have got to start getting angry that our politicians lie like this. I mean, we'd get angry if our children lied to us, if our wives, parents, anyone lied to us, and yet we seem to accept it from politicians. But I can start seeing another worrying trend, that at the next election you're going to see a huge vote for the two major parties, and I think you may well get in, you may well see a lot of votes for some very unusual people, left wing, right wing, with some strange ideas, because I think people are just fed up with politicians lying to us.
Disillusionment in politics. Yes, Lynn.
Well, I was going to say, David, you could argue that you've started to see that voting pattern over the last couple of federal elections, but particularly this one, and quite a lot of commentators since the election have, you know, said, well, perhaps people weren't voting so much for the current government but against the previous government, and that's a worrying voter pattern for me. I mean, I think, you know, almost every government breaks an election promise or two when they come to power, because suddenly they do get their hands on the keys to the Treasury and they're managing a real-world budget in real time. I think the difference this time is the Prime Minister and opposition campaigned very, very, very hard against deceit and lying in government, and so that makes it, I think, difficult to defend a position where you do seem to be doing many backflips on many issues. And, you know, we saw that with Fran Kelly the other day, and we've seen it in the newspapers where people are, and on TV and radio, where the media is playing sound bites, or we're seeing visuals of what was promised prior to the election, as opposed to what's happening in the budget. So I suspect that the issue is, It is that people are feeling lied to, but it's off a benchmark that the Prime Minister himself set about one ought not lie at
true,
all. Ever.
True enough. I agree with that, Lynn. But I also think there's a deeper principle that we need to explore in the country that we have, and it goes to the ethics of all of this behaviour. Like, dishonesty poisons any sort of relationship. You know, whether it's between a child and a parent, a husband and a wife, a boyfriend and a girlfriend, but particularly between a government and their people. If a government starts lying to their people, we have a particularly poisonous relationship in the country. Now, I think we have to demand, and I think David went to it in his comment, we have to demand clearly and loudly that our politicians return to a place where if they don't tell the truth, then they need to explain why they're breaking their promises. That does not happen in Australia at the moment, and the country's the poorer for it, and it enables them to get away with callous, you know, exasperatingly unequal processes and policies like they've put in place this week. We haven't seen the like of this. It's Tea Party come to Australia.
Are we watching an economic mask over an ideological agenda? And that's the key to it, and that ideological agenda is about fundamentally changing the nature of what we've come to know in Australia as the fair go. Philip Huggins, can it be summed up like that, that at issue is what we mean as Australians by the fair go?
Well, it certainly can't be done through deceit, and that's the issue we've just been talking about. I think the government has broken the trust it was given at the election, and we all love living in a democracy, and we've no doubt seen and travelled enough to know what it's like for people who do not live in a democracy and cannot have the kind of conversation we're having tonight. We also know how it needs the best of nurture And we do have to stay on this issue, and we do really need to insist that the Parliament, when it reconvenes, actually themselves start to address this issue, because the quality of our democracy is and will continue to be threatened. Whatever other kind of Machiavellian endeavours there might be coming out of the various think tanks for social engineering, I don't know. But what I do know is that we must have a government that we can trust, or our quality of democracy will be diminished. There's a wonderful old prayer that we be governed quietly and wisely, so that, you know, so the rest of us can get on with the things that we do. You know,
good luck with that.
So we don't have to obsess with politics day and night. We can actually leave the politicians to get on with their contribution. We get on with our contribution. Together, we make a fine civilization. Well, that needs that our political leaders actually attend to the issue they have created.
Phil Glendinning, one could cheekily ask, what's to be said of a Jesuit education?
Well, I'm definitely not going to be defending the Jesuits tonight, John, but I would say they must be disappointed with some of the values that are at work here. I mean, the values that are at play, you know, we're punishing the poor for their poverty. You know, Australian government shouldn't be doing this.
Let's take some more calls to Wayne in Tasmania. Hello, Wayne, how are you?
Good evening. Look, I just want to agree completely with what you said about the ideological aspect of it. I don't think it's financial at all. It's driving through an agenda that the Howard government would like to have put through, but I think they were a bit more astute. This is just the bulldozer straight through. And the thing is, if you maintain a pool of poor or working poor, what that will do, the end result is to smash small business, but big business loves it because you maintain a pool of low-paid casual workers. The other thing is, I think there's big generational differences here. You know, like when I was young, you heard the politicians talking about you know, the dole bludgers, they were living in hippie communes and down the beach surfing all day and living like kings on the dole, and because they grew up from the war and they didn't understand. And it's like the politicians now who come up with free education and come through their times where work was always abundant, they really don't understand what it's like to be a young person today. Mm.
Thanks for your observations. We'll take another call. This is Dennis in Gosford. Hello, Dennis, how are you?
Hello there, John. Thank you for the opportunity to talk. My concerns are quite wide and varied. First, the government are already planning to take the co-payment off the doctors. So the doctors, the co-payment is just to make good what the government have taken from us.
Now, I understand you are a doctor yourself.
Yes, I am. My concerns are for people who are don't have the money, doctors are going to say, well, we can't afford to bulk bill. The costs of running and living have risen by somewhere around about 1,200% from 1982 to the present. If I go back, though, to what the government pays as a co-payment, as the payment to me for Medicare, it's gone up by about 180% from $14 to $35 in the same time. Now, to reduce it further, fewer doctors are going to want to bulk bill. They're all going to have to charge more because you actually have to make a living. Receptionists have to be paid, phone bills have to be paid, power has to be paid, and the government are effectively cutting back. The previous Labour government froze what doctors are going to get. This government not only has frozen it for this year, but from next year they're going to take money away from us. Then we've got to have a look at how many people want to be GPs under these circumstances. I would much rather the government employs all of us as a national health service. People get appointed to a doctor, no more doctor shopping. Let's take it from that way. The costs are known. We don't have over-servicing. That's your lot. We've got to do one other thing, though. We've got to have a look at the number of professional politicians per capita in this country. We have the highest number of paid professional politicians in the world.
Well, there's a debate about states' rights that we could get into and the nature of the Federation. That's taking us in a different direction altogether, Dennis. Look, we'll comment on that on the periphery, but just let's take another call before some comments from Kim in Canberra. Hello, Kim, how are you?
Yeah, good evening. I'd like to offer a contrary view. I think,
please.
I think there's been a lot of what I consider to be self-indulgent indignation about this breaking of promises. There's been a lot of people, I suspect including some of your panellists there tonight, who would have argued that the government should have broken its promise on stopping the boats, should have broken its promise on repealing the carbon tax, etc. So I think there's a lot of people are being very selective in what they're objecting to. And at the other end of the spectrum, I think every time I turn the news on or read the paper, there are people saying there should be more money spent on whatever. And the money just is not there. We have to take a hard stance somewhere. Now, sure, let's have an argument about whether this particular initiative or that particular initiative is good. But I think this whole notion of indignation about trying to balance the budget is just very self-indulgent and people taking their own personal agenda.
What about it falling disproportionately on the poor?
Well, it depends very much on your metrics. I mean, you read some of the articles by some of the economists and they say, well, it's not disproportionate. Everyone is taking a slice. I'm right on that cusp of retirement. I mean, I'd much rather retire on more money, but I'm not going to. I'm going to retire on less. But at the end of the day, I think we have to take a slice of... we all have to take a slice of that hit. And I guess part of the argument is that there are more people in need than there are people who are able to pay a lot more tax. So, you know, at the end of the day, some of these things have to be balanced out. Now, all I'd like to see is a rational debate on where should some of these things occur, and perhaps, you know, should the GST be increased and things like that. Not this focus on, oh, that was a lie, therefore that's where we put our attention. I think we're missing the point. Something has to be done to the budget. The government is doing something. Let's debate about whether they're right or wrong.
All right. I think we established part of the parameters of that with Peter Martin earlier in our discussion. But one other call from Ken, who's been sitting on the Hume Highway waiting patiently. Hello, Ken. How are you?
Good, mate. Yourself?
Yeah. What would you like to say?
Yeah, I'd just like to know with Tony Abbott, where's the jobs coming from? There's none here. And then now he's cutting funding to these people on the dole and the age pension and stuff like that. Well, why doesn't all these rich people like Richard Branson and all that go, hang on, let's put our hand in our pocket and let us pay more money. Instead, no, all he's doing is sitting back and making the richer richer and the poorer poorer. Like, put a challenge out there to Tony Abbott and Joe Hockey. Why don't they go and live in a Department of Housing house for 6 months? Why don't they pay their own bills and all that type of stuff? Find out exactly how hard it is to live instead of having chauffeur-driven cars around, have maids and everybody else...
I think we get the message there. It's about equity and it is about sharing it. Look, let me come back finally because we've only got 2 or 3 minutes to go. This hour has gone fleetingly fast. The question that I asked earlier or set up earlier is, are we having a debate about the nature of the fair go in this country, and are we seeing a profound shift in the way that debate has been articulated, one that perhaps we haven't seen in 60 years since the Second World War? Phil, very briefly.
Yeah, look, absolutely. And whether it's the poor overseas or the poor here bearing that disproportionate burden, we've got to a point now where compassion for people quite often is seen as a form of weakness, rather than under that traditional notion of the fair go, it was actually probably our greatest civilising strength. And I think you play around with that at your peril. And I think we, you know, this is a serious moment in our history.
Peter Martin, 30 seconds.
I think Kim from Canberra is absolutely right. I do. The rest of the panel doesn't, I think, that we're actually living in a post-truth world. And when we heard Tony Abbott say those things, we had a fair idea of the sort of direction he'd really be moving in. The good thing is there are elections every 3 years, and we do get to, after the event, we do get to decide. So, yes, there are big changes, but they mightn't last forever.
Lynn Hatfield-Dodds, briefly.
We do have a structural imbalance in the budget. We're spending way more than we're raising, so we do need to look at expenditure and revenue. I guess my hope is that we don't do that primarily off the backs of the most vulnerable.
And Philip Huggins, the end of the fair go?
No, we'll keep working from our various vantage points to try and give hope to those who need us to help them to feel some hope about the future.
Thank you all for joining us on Sunday night. Time has gone too briefly to Bishop Philip Huggins, Lynn Hatfield-Dodds, Peter Martin and Phil Glendenning. It's been great to have you on Sunday night. This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.